This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the Territorial News newspaper, published November 27, 2024. Chief of Scouts, Al Siber. Though a friend to the Apaches who served under him as scouts, Al Siber was a relentless and resourceful foe to warriors he was paid to pursue. Siber became a legendary scout in Arizona during the 1870s and 1880s and watched as his fame spread nationwide following campaigns against Apache leaders Victoria and Geronimo. Albert Siber was born on February 29, 1844, in Mingolsheim, Germany. His father died when Al was only 1 year old, but his indomitable mother managed to immigrate to the United States in 1849. The Sibers settled in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and lived there for 7 years. When he was 12, Al moved with his mother and married sister to the logging settlement of Minneapolis in Minnesota Territory. As a teenager, he apparently worked as a teamster and as a volunteer policeman. At age 18, Siber joined Company B of the 1st Minnesota Volunteers. His first Civil War campaign was at the Siege of Yorktown, Virginia, where his skill with a rifle earned him duty as a sharpshooter. He fought at Chancellorsville and at Gettysburg. Siber was wounded in the head and leg, and he spent 5 months in the hospital. Although promoted to corporal in 1864, Siber saw no further combat. Siber headed west of the Mississippi early the following year. He drifted around, working on a variety of occupations. He lived in San Francisco for a few months, then became a tie cutter for the Central Pacific Railroad. He ventured to the mining district of Nevada, where he worked as a road grader near the mining town of Virginia City. He prospected at White Pine in Utah, and he helped drive a horse herd from Southern California to Prescott, Arizona in 1868. In Prescott, he met such noted scouts and guides as Dan O'Leary, Ed Peck, and John Benjamin Townsend. From these veteran scouts, Siber received invaluable instruction about the countryside and about Native Americans. This information proved helpful when he became the foreman of a ranch in Williamson Valley, which was frequently raided by Indians. Siber saw his first action against Apache while riding in pursuit parties. By 1871, Siber was scouting for the cavalry. He also tried his hand at prospecting once again, but he was unsuccessful. That year, General George Crook was assigned the command of the Department of Arizona, and the gifted Indian fighter needed men like Al Siber. Crook developed a strategy for systematically crisscrossing Apache territory with small units that regularly fought or harassed any Indians encountered, thus making life on the reservation seem more desirable. A key to Crook's success was his widespread use of reservation braves as scouts. Siber and other experienced Arizona frontiersmen found steady employment leading these Native American allies. Siber was hired during the flurry of activity following the Loring Massacre on November 5, 1871, in which 6 men on a stagecoach were killed by Apaches near Wickenburg. His pay was $125 a month, compared to the $13 per month received by Army privates. At the conclusion of the winter campaign of 1872-73, Siber was one of few scouts retained on a steady basis. During the late winter and spring of 1874, Lieutenant Walter Schuller led a sweeping expedition consisting of Company K of the 5th Cavalry, a pack train of 80 mules, and 122 scouts commanded by Siber. The expedition ranged 1,500 miles in 3 months, regularly routing bands of Apaches after Siber's scouts had located the rancherios. Siber tended to discipline his scouts strictly, and on this expedition, at least one was executed by hanging. On other occasions, Cyber was known to shoot disobedient scouts. Two of his men once decided to kill him in camp. Forewarned by a loyal scout, Cyber shot one of the would-be murderers in the head as he crept toward his bedroll. The other culprit tried to run, but Cyber shot him dead as well. When the column returned to Camp Verde late in May, the women who had captured during the operation were asked where they wanted to go. About 50 of them walked over to stand beside some of the Apache scouts. The scouts, in turn, agreed to marry them. Schuyler felt that a ceremony was in order, and he turned to Cyber. The chief of scouts explained the white men's concept of marriage, told them to join hands, and pronounced them man and wife. From 1873 through 1879, Cyber was regularly in the field as the chief of scouts and the only permanent guide at Camp Verde. In 1875, the Verde Reservation was closed, although the military post remained in operation. Nearly 1,500 Native Americans were transferred to the San Carlos Reservation. While en route, an intertribal battle erupted, causing at least 15 casualties. The toll might have been higher if it hadn't been for Cyber, who stepped between the lines, braved the crossfire, and quelled the shooting by his raw courage. Throughout the 1880s, Cyber remained employed as chief of scouts in Arizona. When Crook was reassigned to Arizona in 1883, Cyber accompanied him on a dangerous mission into Mexico's Sierra Madre Apache stronghold. Afterward, Cyber and Lieutenant Britton Davis were given a relatively free hand to run San Carlos Reservation. Unfortunately, Cyber's negligence in forwarding a warning from Davis to Crook in 1885 led to a breakout by 134 Chiricahuas. Davis and Cyber led a pursuit column into Mexico, but after several fruitless weeks, Crook ordered Cyber to return to San Carlos to help pacify the Apaches there. Consequently, Cyber missed the climactic campaign that resulted in Geronimo's final surrender in 1886. On January 1st of the following year, Cyber was wounded in a melee at San Carlos involving the Apache Kid, who had served as a scout under Cyber. The Apache Kid had killed a man over the death of his father. Deciding to give himself up, the Kid rode into San Carlos with several followers. Cyber persuaded the Kid and his friends to hand over their guns. As Cyber placed the weapons near his tent, shooting began. He darted into a tent for a gun, but when he emerged, an Apache named Curly shattered his left foot with a rifle slug. The Apache Kid fled. He was later arrested, but he escaped again and was never recaptured. Bedridden at San Carlos for several months, Cyber never regained full use of his left leg. He traveled by train to Minneapolis for a visit with his family in 1889, and not long after his return to San Carlos, he was fired by the commandant, Captain John L. Bullis. Cyber disapproved of the way Bullis treated the Apaches. When his criticism became too vivacious, the captain found a pretext for dismissal. After his days as a scout were over, Cyber drifted around Arizona, finding permanence in neither job nor home. Around the turn of the century, he moved to Roosevelt, where he managed a gang of Apache who were grading a road to the site of the future Roosevelt Dam. On February 19, 1907, on the Tonto Road near Globe, Arizona, Cyber was crushed to death by falling rocks while on the job. Though rumors circulated that Apache workmen had toppled the rocks deliberately, most considered Cyber's death accidental. The famous old chief of scouts was buried in Globe. In their own words, a young boy's first buffalo hunt. Author Luther Standing Bear and Ogallala Sioux was an author, educator, philosopher, and actor. He fought to preserve Lakota heritage and sovereignty and was at the forefront of a progressive movement to change government policy toward Native Americans. The following account is excerpted from his book, My People, the Sioux. A scout had been sent out, and one morning, very early, he reported that there were some buffalo near. Everybody, including myself, began to get ready. Well, one of my stepmothers was helping me. She said, "Son, when you kill a buffalo, save me a kidney and the skin." I didn't know whether she was trying to poke fun at me or to give me encouragement, but it made me feel proud to have her talk like that to me. But my father always talked to me as if I were a man. Of course, I now felt that I was big enough to do a man's work. The night before the hunt, my father instructed me as follows. "My son, the land on which these buffalo have been found is reported not to be rough, and you will not have to chase the buffalo into dangerous places, as the land is very level. Whatever you do, watch the buffalo closely. If the one you are after is running straight ahead and not turning, then you can get in very close, and you will stand a good chance to shoot it in the heart. But if you observe the buffalo to be looking at you from the corner of its eyes, then look out. They are very quick and powerful. They can get their horns under your horse and toss him high in the air, and you might get killed. If you hit it in the right spot, you may kill the buffalo with only one arrow. But if not, you will have to use more. If your pony is not fast enough to catch up with the buffalo, the best thing you can do is to shoot an arrow right behind the small ribs. Perhaps it will reach the heart. If the buffalo runs down a hill or into a bank, then you have another chance. Shoot at the joint of the hip. Then your buffalo will sit down and you can take your time to kill it. Keep your eyes open. In the beginning, there will be lots of dust. But after you pass through that, it will be clear, and you will be able to see where you are going." This was the first time I was going to go on a hunt after such large animals. I had killed several small animals, but a buffalo was far from being a small creature, and you can imagine that I was greatly excited. Early the next morning, everyone was ready for the start. I carried my bow in my hand, as there was not enough room for it in my quiver where I kept my arrows. I rode a little black mare, a very fine runner that could cover the ground like a deer. Two men on beautiful horses rode in front of us. This was for the purpose of keeping order in the party. There was no chance of one man getting ahead of the others and scaring the game. We all had to keep together and stay behind these men. They rode to the top of a hill where they could get a good look at the herd and figure that if there was any better place from which to approach it. We always got as close to the buffalo as possible, because it makes the meat tough to run an animal any further than necessary. After looking at the herd from various positions, they chose what was considered the most advantageous spot. Here they cautioned the hunters to change to their running horses and be all ready. I did not have to make any change, as the little black mare was all the animal I had. I saw some of the men tying their two braids of hair back, and others who wore shirts began rolling up their sleeves. They wanted their arrows free once they began shooting. They fixed their quivers on the side instead of carrying them on the back. Nobody wore any feathers, or carried any spears, or lances. The extra horses were hobbled and left in the charge of an old man. When the two riders gave the command, everybody started right up. Of course, I was right at the front with them. I wanted to do something brave. I depended a great deal on my pony, as I knew she was sure-footed and can run as I wanted her to. At the top of a hill, all the hunters turned their horses loose, and the animals started in running like the wind. I whipped up my little black mare and nearly got ahead of the others. Soon I was mixed up in the dust and could see nothing ahead of me. All I could hear was the roar and rattle of the hooves of the buffalo as they thundered along. My pony shied this way and that, and I had to hold on for dear life. For a time, I did not even try to pull an arrow from my quiver, as I had all I could do to take care of myself. I knew if my pony went down and one of those big animals stepped on me, it would be my last day on earth. I then realized how helpless I was there in all that dust and confusion, with those ponderous buffalo all around me. The sound of their hooves was frightening. My pony ran like the wind while I just clung to her mane. But presently, we came out of the dust. Then I observed what my father had told me previously. I was quite a bit ahead of the buffalo now, and when they caught sight of me, they started running in two different directions. When I looked at those big animals and thought of trying to kill one of them, I realized how small I was. I was really afraid of them. Then I thought about what my stepmother had said to me about bringing her a kidney and a skin, and the feeling that I was a man, after all, came back to me. So I turned my pony towards the bunch which was running north. There was no dust now, and I knew where I was going. I was all alone, and I was determined to chase them, whether I killed one or not. By this time, I could hear shots fired by some of the hunters who carried guns, and I knew they were killing some. So I rode on after this small bunch, and when I dashed behind them, I pulled out one of my arrows and shot in the middle of them. I did not even know where my arrow went, and was just thinking of quitting when I observed a young heifer running slower than the others. This encouraged me, so I whipped up my pony again and took after her. As I came up in close, she stopped and turned. Then she started running in another direction, but I saw she was losing fast. She was not as big as the others, so I was not afraid. I made up my mind. I was going to kill that buffalo if it took all the arrows in my quiver. I rode up alongside the buffalo, just as my father had instructed me. Drawing an arrow from my quiver and holding to my pony with all the strength of my legs, I fitted the arrow and let drive with all my strength. I had expected to kill the buffalo right quick, but the arrow went into the neck, and I thought I had taken such good aim. But the buffalo only shook her head and kept running. I again caught up with her and let another arrow loose, which struck near the heart. Although it was not fired with sufficient strength to kill at once, I saw that she was fast weakening and running much slower. Then I pulled my third arrow and fired again. This went into the heart. I began to think that buffalo had all the nine lives of a cat and was going to prove about as hard as a cat to kill when I saw blood running from her nose. Then I knew she would have to drop pretty soon. I shot my fourth arrow into her, and she staggered and dropped over on her side and was soon dead. So I had killed my first buffalo. When I examined the fallen animal and noted that I had shot five arrows into her, I felt that this was too many arrows for just one buffalo. Then I recalled that my father had once killed two buffalo with only a single arrow. He knew he had hit the first one in the right spot, as the arrow penetrated very deeply, and he simply rode up alongside, drew the arrow through, pulled it out again, and used it to kill the second one. As I stood there thinking of this, it made me feel ashamed of my marksmanship. I began to think of pulling all the arrows out but one. In fact, I had started to do this when a remark that my father had once made to me came into my head. It was, "Son, always remember that a man who tells lies is never liked by anybody." So instead of trying to cheat, I told the truth, and it made me feel happier. I took all the arrows out and started in to skin the buffalo. I was doing splendidly until I tried to turn the animal over. Then I discovered that was too heavy a task for me. As I had but one side skinned, I began to think of removing the kidney and cutting out a nice piece of meat for my stepmother. Just then I heard someone call me. I got on my pony and rode to the top of the hill. There I saw my father, who had been looking for me. He called to me, but I just rode back to my buffalo. He knew something had happened, so came over, and then I pointed to the dead buffalo, lying there half-skinned. He was pleased that I had tried to do my best. Then I told him about the number of arrows I had to use and where each one had struck. I even told him how I had shot my first arrow into the whole bunch, not knowing where it had landed. He laughed, but he was proud of me. I guess it was because I had told the truth and not tried to cheat or lie, even though I was just a youngster. Then Father started in on my buffalo. He soon had it all skinned and butchered. He said he had been all ready to go home when he discovered I was missing. He had thought I was with my grandfather, while Grandfather thought I was with him. All that time, I was having a hard job all to myself. When we reached home, it made me very proud to be able to give my stepmother the skin and kidney. And she was pleased that I had done so well. My father called the old man of the camp who always acted as herald to announce that Ote Kete, Plenty Kill, the boyhood name of Chief Standing Bear, had shot his first buffalo, and that Standing Bear, his father, was giving away a horse. Arizona, Web of Time, written by Jim Harvey. Arizona American Indians once depended on a large variety of wild plants. They included yucca, which minus its spiny leaves, was eaten after it was roasted in a pit and dried. Juice was used as waterproofing, and people drank it to prevent scurvy. Nets, sandals, and thread were made from yucca fiber. Another variety of the plant produced edible fruit. The roots were pounded and soaked in water to create suds for washing hair. Some Indians today still use yucca shampoo. Those who saw Cochise, the Apache Indian chief in the late 1850s, said there was red paint on his face and he had earrings made of brass wire. A pendant of wire bent into a ring dangled from his nose. There was an eagle feather in his hair and he wore moccasins. Clifton, near the New Mexico border, began as a mining camp in 1872. Today, the town has 47 buildings listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Flagstaff lived by the gun in the early 1880s. A man who was there remembered the sound of shooting at all hours of the night. "Many died those days with their boots on," he said. Men sometimes were knifed or beaten to death. The brakes failed on a freight train with two steam engines and 31 cars traveling down that downhill slope just west of Williams in 1897. The lead engine jumped the tracks and the second engine and the cars crashed into it. Three crewmen were killed. At Camp Verde south of Sedona in 1904, most residents were short of cash. So they paid the local doctor for services rendered with hay, grain, pigs, chickens, ducks, a horse, or a cow. Camp Verde got its name from a military post located there. Western novelist Zane Grey's book, Wild Horse Mesa, was filmed in 1925 on the Navajo Reservation and at the Grand Canyon. The animal hero was a trained horse named Greylock. He went on to star in a series of silent movies as Rex, King of Wild Horses. Cheyenne Prayer for Peace. Let us know peace, for as long as the moon shall rise, for as long as the rivers shall flow, for as long as the sun shall shine, for as long as the grass shall grow, let us know peace. 150 years ago in the West. All of these occurred in November of 1874, different dates. November 3rd. The prospectors who are flocking to the Black Hills in Dakota Territory are the subject of a meeting between President Grant and Generals Philip Sheridan and George Crook, Indian Affairs Commissioner Edward P. Smith, and others. The government will have no official policy toward the prospectors. Colonel Randall McKenzie reports two Indians killed and 19 captured by the 4th Cavalry on the Laguna Chirato in Texas. November 5th, the new San Francisco Mint is transferred to the control of General O.H. LaGrange. the 6th. Graybeard's Cheyenne Camp near McLean's Creek, Texas, is attacked by a detachment of the 8th Cavalry under Lieutenant Frank Baldwin. Julia and Adelaide Germain, the 6 and 4-year-old daughters of John Germain, who were kidnapped from their wagon train in Kansas the previous spring, are rescued. 4 Indians and 2 soldiers are killed. The 8th. Lieutenant Colonel J.W. Davidson reports that his expedition from Fort Sill that began on October 28th captured 391 Indians. The 16th of November. The Colorado River Indian Reservation's boundaries are expanded by executive order. The 17th. A mild earthquake is reported in Yuma, Arizona. The 24th. The DeKalb, Illinois farmer Joseph Glidden is granted a patent for barbed wire. The 29th, Hawaii's King Kalakua visits San Francisco. This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, all lowercase. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.